This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, I slipped a little one in on you there this past week whenever I attended the 4F convention, virtual convention, actually, 49.5. It was kind of in between. Last year, they're supposed to have held it, and it was postponed from the year before, in which they were going to be celebrating their 50th. Anyhow, they had a virtual one-day convention, and I gave a report on that. I thought it'd be interesting because it was something that was a little bit different, something that was an invitation-only kind of a thing that everybody gets to participate. But a lot of people are interested in what's going on inside. Plus, if someone is considering maybe organizing your own virtual convention, then perhaps some of the ideas and tips that we discussed there might help you to develop your own virtual convention then too. But one of the things I like to start off with my podcast is to recognize those who have helped to support the Magic Word podcast with their financial contribution. And I do want to thank and welcome Mark Rich as our newest friend of the Magic Word. Thank you, Mark, for your donation. That's very much appreciated and helps keep the Magic Word on the air and free for the rest of the world. If any of the rest of you would like to find out more information, that's all on the website at themagicwordpodcast.com. This week, we're also at the end of this podcast going to announce the winner of the contest. A couple of weeks ago, we had Alan Kronzik on, who had written a book called Grandpa Magic, and he had graciously agreed to give away a copy of his book. And I'm going to announce that winner's name again on the backside of this podcast. So stay tuned after you're finished listening to TC Tahoe. I started to say TC Pothole. That's not who we have. We actually have Tahoe, TC Tahoe. Anyhow, so that is my guest this week, and someone I've been wanting to chat with for quite a while. He has been around kind of on the down low from the standpoint he doesn't really attend conventions and nor do a lot of TV work, and he discusses that in this podcast episode. But he also is not only known for his sleight of hand skills and being nominated so many times for different rooms in the Magic Castle from the Academy of Magical Arts, but also because of his work doing tarot reading and on the bizarre side of our art. And he's going to discuss some of that as well. It's kind of funny. When I stop and think about that for just a moment, it reminds me of John Ferrantino, who made a successful career as a comedian, but then now is also doing seances and kind of bizarre type of things. And here is another fellow who is a comedian doing it as well, and very successful at it too. And anyhow, I think you're going to enjoy everything that TC has to say here this week. So please welcome my guest, Mr. TC Tahoe, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Thanks again for tuning into this week's episode of The Magic Word. We have a wonderful guest with us here tonight, someone who is a world-class sleight-of-hand artist. He worked at the Magic Island in Newport Beach and here in Houston, Texas for a long number of years at the Magic Island. That's right. And also, he does a lot of tarot card readings, and we'll talk a little bit about that then, too. He was a two-time winner, Magician of the Year by the Academy of Magical Arts, and they had also nominated him, I believe, five times for the Stage Magician of the Year, three times for the Close-Up Magician, and five times as the Lecturer of the Year. And he is a very funny guy, worked a lot of improvisational stand-up comedy shops around the country. Even Robin Williams has a Robin Williams quote on his website where he says, "You make me laugh." And also Denzel Washington thought he was a great, too funny, too amazing. And Pierce Brosnan, one of a kind. Anyhow, he's just a wonderful guy and a very funny fella. I think you will enjoy getting to know TC Tahoe as our guest together today. So please welcome Mr. TC Tahoe. Hey, TC.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
Fantastic. Good to have you here as a guest this week. I've been noticing a lot of things like on Instagram where you have been designing a whole lot of stuff. I mean, like your promo material where it's very, very clever kind of things where you'll take like an old picture and add a little bit of a twist to it. Or, you know. Yeah. Are you a designer? Actually, did you start out like as a or how did you get your design, your eye? I mean, it's very clever stuff.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Self-taught. I've only ever been a magician for a living, really. I got out of high school. I actually dropped out of high school about 3 months before I was supposed to graduate. And Because I got booked at Newport Beach Magic Island from Montana. And I went out there for a couple of weeks and never went home. At one point, about 6 years ago, I was living in Ecuador for 3 years. My wife and I had moved down there. Leslie and I moved down to Ecuador. And I didn't really tell anybody I was a magician. It wasn't like I was hiding it, but I didn't promote it either. I was just going to relax for a while and do nothing, which is one of my favorite things to do. my heroes are Winnie the Pooh and Baloo the Bear. So, you know, just whatever.
Okay. I noticed that some of the photos or illustrations you've done, seems like you've incorporated them.
Yes. I love them. Well, I started learning Photoshop and Illustrator. I took some courses down there because I've always enjoyed artwork, but it was always a hobby. And then when I eventually ended up coming back to the States, I took this newfound hobby and started promoting all the shows I was doing by making my own flyers and posters.
Yeah.
Basically for social media, because I'd been out of the country and pretty much out of the magic scene for 3 years, I thought it was important to kind of promote every little show I did. So that's why I just started blasting these posters out and had a great time doing those. I still do. I make them for other people too. But I just wanted to really push that I was doing shows, and statistically, it seems that more people will click on a picture than just words. So right. I just started doing, you know, everything from 50s pulp covers to, you know, like DJ posters I would see, and I'd adapt to magic and
just kind of inspired by pop art in general.
I have a wide range of tastes, you know. I mean, I've got a Winnie the Pooh shelf over there, and I've got Demons from Hell over here. So everything in between.
and you lie in between there somewhere.
Exactly. I don't know that they're all from hell, but they're demons. So yeah.
I think it's important there when you said that you are also doing these sometimes for other people. It's important that people recognize they couldn't and shouldn't do it all, but you should farm this out to somebody else who is a professional in that case.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've always been a bit of a control freak myself. Any poster or flyer or book cover, whatever I do, I've got a few people that I send it to and say, what do you think of this? Just to get input. You know, mm-hmm. My tastes aren't everybody's.
Well, I would think, again, some people would have seen the designs that you make and say, I kind of like that. I think I'll contact TC about maybe he could do something with me because I kind of like this look that he has.
Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I've done locally here in Florida. I mean, the whole state, I guess, isn't really locally, but I've done for Florida magicians, I've done quite a few posters for shows that were print posters that they were doing, you know, they were putting up places and stuff. And yeah, I do whatever I can.
So you've kind of, you're bi-coastal where you are now in Florida, but you started off in California and as mentioned, you had apparently been to the Magic Castle enough where they had seen you often enough to nominate you for just about every room in the house.
I'm very lucky. I'm one of the few people that have been nominated at that time in the 90s. I was nominated for all the major awards in 1 year. I was nominated for lecturer, close-up, parlor, and stage all in 1 year.
All in 1 year.
Yeah, which was kind of cool. And I lost all those. So that was, you know, felt a bit like Susan Lucci. Hey, there's something right in the zeitgeist, right?
Okay. Boy, that is true. This is broadcast all over the world, obviously. And for people who don't know who Susan Lucci is, she's a 27-time loser. Yeah. She, or something like that, of the afternoon soap opera star who gets nominated every year. And I think she may have won recently.
She won eventually, but it was 20 of the nominations without winning.
For the Emmy nominations of her work. But she always recognized, but didn't quite make it each time. It was kind of funny. But between there, obviously, you were working then at the improv shop, I guess, and different comedy clubs in and around California. Yeah,
I worked the improv a couple of times. I worked the comedy store. I worked the Laugh Stop down in Newport Beach, Long Beach Comedy Club. The one of the owners of Magic Island in Newport was Mike Cayley, and he was owner of the Laugh Stop. And he liked me at the Magic Island, so he got me to come in and do some emceeing at his comedy club. And that kind of was the springboard for me doing a lot of comedy clubs.
That reminds me of something. I remember the Magic and Comedy Club being advertised years ago. And for some reason, I was thinking that converted into the Magic Island, but that's not the case. There were two separate places.
The Magic Comedy Club, Mike Lacey, I think Mike is still involved, is down at Hermosa Beach. And okay. It is, yeah, no, it's a totally separate place. Magic Island is in Newport Beach, was in Newport Beach, basically built into the side of a parking structure in a very upscale little area. Maybe it was called Via Porto. I think it was the little street, little pedestrian street. And yeah, it was just a private club that these guys, you know, liked the Magic Castle and wanted to build something of their own, but make money at it. So they charged, there was a huge membership fee. And then there were still monthly fees. And I mean, people were, you know, it was $1,000, you know, night
entry
for
fees.
One person. Yeah, just to, you know, for dinner and shows. It was a stupid amount of money. I got there in the year before the Olympics, 83, mm-hmm. and I was 20, and I was making between $300 and $600 a week in tips.
Wow.
And I had never had a job. I literally dropped out of high school. I was making that in tips, and I was making, I think my starting salary was $500 a week. So I was like in heaven. I'm going, you know, this was a dream come true for a 20-year-old that just was, this is all I wanted to do then. And it was my first gig.
I was thinking that the Magic Island actually, well, I know in Houston, of course, was kind of what they call country club billing. You went in to begin with, you give them your credit card, they gave you a number with a little card, and you used that all evening long. So you really didn't know how much your tally was going to be until you came out at the end of the evening. And I think that the biggest surprise of the evening was whenever you got your bill and you go, for what?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was, you came in with your membership card and everything went on that. Right. And I think for a while, they were, you just went in and charged everything in your card and you walked out. You signed something at the end of the night, but you didn't pay until
they would charge and bill you.
Yeah.
Well, that comes back again to the tips on there. I don't recall. Well, I got a couple of tips where people had given me cash, but I mean, I can count on one hand the number of tips I got over the years and years I worked at the Magic Island here in Houston. So did they tip you physically and give you bills, or did they add it on to the bill, or how did that work back then?
It was cash. And I mean, and this, again, this was, you know, the early 80s. So yeah. Cash was still flowing. You know, I mean, it was just, I would get paid a couple hundred bucks to do a private show in a room that wasn't hosting a show at the moment.
Yep. Gotcha.
So, you know, like, here's a couple hundred bucks, do something for my wife. And I'd go in there and we'd do a little, you know, 15-minute private show for a couple $100.
Yeah. You know? I remember one time doing a cardiographic as part of my regular show. And after it was over, a guy came back and said, hey, it was my wife's birthday. Can you sign this to her? Because I had her as a volunteer, as it happened. And right. Put her name on there, personalized it, and they gave me $100 just for that. So it wasn't like, again, the close-up strolling thing I was doing. It was actually, it got tipped afterwards by a patron for the stage show I did, which was kind of nice, clearly unexpected, you know, back then. Things have changed. And the Magic Island, I went through a lot of changes from the standpoint of it going from private to public. I know we just had quite a monumental shift in Houston when it went from one to the other. And for a short time, mm-hmm. it was even, they had like, B actors or singers. I mean, you had like Tiny Tim and Frank Sinatra Jr. and different people who came in for like about 6 months, and that just wasn't working. It had nothing to do with magic, nothing to do with comedy. No. They just had a stage, and they were trying to make it this into some sort of a venue, which didn't work.
Yeah.
And so they also, of course, had gone from being a private club to a public club and just having a fee. And I believe they did the same thing then in Newport Beach. Isn't that right?
They did, and by the time they started doing that, the late 80s, the club was really kind of,
it on wasn't last legs.
Yeah, it wasn't. There was really not. A couple came in, and I'll be damned if I can remember their names. A married couple came in and bought the Magic Island in Newport Beach with the sole purpose of finding investors to open up Wizards up on City Walk in studios up in, you know, Universal Studios.
Oh.
So they kept it kind of nice, but once the once they had their investors, they didn't care about it anymore because they were moving on to the bigger project.
So were they the ones who ended up creating Wizards?
Yes. And I followed them up there. I ended up working up there too. So,
which is still operating, I believe. Is that right?
That I do not know because I left California in 2000.
Right. Yeah.
I know that Fred Ward, I don't know if you ever knew Fred.
Yep. That's the name I was trying to think of, Fred Ward. He was the entertainment. He was like Scott Hollingsworth's counterpart. Yes. Yeah. Scott Hollingsworth was the entertainment director at the Magic Island here in Houston, and Fred was the one for Wizards. Yeah. Yep. And also, didn't Fred do the Magic Island in Newport Beach?
Sure did. Yes, he did. The main showroom in Magic Island Newport Beach was the King Tut. Is that what it's called?
Palace of Tutankhamun.
And when I started there, and for a few years, probably 5 years, Mark Hendrickson was the host in that room. Mm-hmm. And he taught me a lot about emceeing. And then once he left, I ended up hosting for a while, and then Fred was a host, but he would come in and work with his wife, Wanda, Fred and Wanda. They were such nice people.
And then you were saying when you came to Houston and worked on a regular basis back then, Becky Blaney was booking at the time.
Becky was. I was there. I was there. I think in 85 and 86 for probably 4-5 weeks at a time each. You know, the beginning of each year, I came in for the New Year's Eve.
Back when you were both single and you had a crush on her.
Oh, yes, I did. Yeah.
As a lot of people did back then.
How could you not?
Yeah.
How could you not?
Very cute. Very nice lady.
She was adorable. I used to, on the New Year's Eve week, maybe, I don't know where, if John, Johnny Thompson and Pam were there for 2 weeks. And I went and picked them up at the airport, and that's the first time I ever met them. And it was beyond exciting for me. I mean, they were obviously heroes of mine. And to see Johnny Thompson was just livid when he came off the airplane.
Why is that?
He came. I was holding a sign. I stood there holding a sign. I went that far, stood at the gate, back when you could stand at the gate, stood at the gate with a sign. Obviously, I didn't need to because I would recognize them, but I got them. And Johnny walked past me and goes, "Yeah, okay, I'm here. Let's go get my bags." And Pam just looked at me and went, "Ignore him." And we're driving, and Johnny is sitting in the back, and he's just going, "Motherfucker, son of a mother." And I said, "Is there anything I can do?" And Pam looks at me, and pardon me, but she looks at me and says, "I'm sorry." And she turns around and says to Johnny, "Put a dick in it, will you?" And I was like, these guys are even better in person. It turns out that one of Johnny's, somebody he considered a friend, had stolen one of his jokes and used it on a stage. And Johnny was pissed.
Yeah.
He was so mad. And so when I was alone with Pam, I said, "What joke was it?" And it was the joke was, "You guys are a great audience. I wish I had a better act."
Wow, that's an old joke, I thought.
Yes, but it was Johnny's. And John, this was the next day, and Johnny and Pam, I invited them to come see my parlor show, Cleopatra's Chambers, I believe it was called.
This is it.
Mm-hmm. And because this was in Houston, and they came in, and I look out through the curtain, and Johnny's sitting there like this. I'm going, "Oh, he's still mad. I don't want him to see me in this mood." So I come out, and I do about 15 minutes, and he hasn't really smiled. Pam's laughing. And so I often say things while my brain is screaming, "Don't do that. Don't say that." But I can't stop it. So I just paused. I looked at the audience and I said, "You guys are a great audience. I wish I had Tom Sony's act." And he looked up and went, "Ha!" Ah! And then he was great. We were friends after that.
So that was a nice little twist, I guess, on
it was
kind of take the sting out of that a little bit.
Yeah. So, Did you remember Ricky Dunn?
Boy, do I. Yes, I remember looking at Ricky many a time. And he was a guy who could also, at the just a drop of a dime, could just turn and get upset with the volunteers on stage. He was one of those guys who could be just on fire, or else he could really be on fire.
Yeah, absolutely. And our first meeting was cordial. I mean, I didn't know who he was, really. I mean, I knew of him. I'm one of those guys that, until I look in the mirror and realize I'm an old guy, I still like seeking. I always have looked to talk to the people that have been doing it longer than I have. Mm-hmm. I want their stories. I want to know, you know, things. I just the way I am. And I knew that Ricky had been around, and so I wanted to talk to him. And he was cordial enough. He came to my show and afterwards left without saying a word. And I was like, okay, maybe he was just in a hurry, and I tracked him down. And like I said, we had gone out to dinner, and he was really nice to me. And when I said, what'd you think of my show? And he said, well, I think your show, you little punk, you stole my lesbian joke.
Oh, man.
I was like, what? And I'm racking my brain going, I don't do a lesbian joke. And it turns out that I used to do this line where I'd come out right at the beginning and notice whatever lady was in the front row, I would look at them and go, oh, hi, how are you? You know what? I think I'd like you for my wife. No, I think she'd like you.
Okay, I get it.
And
nice little double entendre.
Well, yeah, and I never considered it really a lesbian joke. I considered it a wife joke. And when Ricky came in to yell at me out of nowhere, I thought, fine, you want to be angry? That's your deal. I'm not going to be involved. But he actually went out of his way to come into my dressing room 2 days later and start screaming at me about it again. And that's when I realized what the joke he was talking about was. And I said, I did not steal that joke from you. I stole that joke from Dorothy Parker. It's a Dorothy Parker line that she said to somebody.
That was a long time ago.
It was, I can't remember. It was a big time actor at the time said to her, I'd like you for my wife. And Dorothy Parker said, well, you think she'd like me? So
that was the full line.
That is the joke. Well, and I just adapted it, you know, and,
sure.
And when I told Ricky that, he went, all right, fine. And then we ended up being good friends, you know, and I realized years later that his anger wasn't real. And really?
Why was he doing that?
I don't know, but I know that he could turn it off and turn it on, because I was at the Magic Castle walking up the stairs, and he was having a go at the maitre d'. He was screaming, and it was Peter Mooy. He was screaming at him. He was going, you son of a bitch. I told you the table I wanted you. And he sees me, and he's going, you son of a bitch. Hey, TC, how you doing? You son of a bitch. And I was like, what? He just turned it off. Hey, how you doing? And then right back to it. You know, I mean, right. So it wasn't, it was just a character for him, I think.
Well, I thought it was because one of those things is he was maybe testing you to see if you knew the provenance of that joke and what your skill or your knowledge, your depth of knowledge was. I think he, a lot of times, would tell people he had invented things full well knowing that he didn't, but thinking, okay, well, I will say this with such certainty that people will think, yeah, I guess he did. And if you disagree with him and you can tell him where it came from, then just as you had said, you say, well, yeah, you're right.
Right.
But otherwise, the two guys I always thought was fun to get into a room together was Bev Bergeron and Ricky Dunn.
Yes. You know, I being very fortunate and that I was good friends with both of those guys.
Yeah,
you know, they both, at least to my face, liked me, which I can't ask for any more than that. I thought Ricky Dunn had one of the best promo ideas I'd ever seen. I didn't see it. I heard about it. I saw pictures of it. He took out, I think it was in the 70s, he took out a full-page ad in Variety in Los Angeles. And the full-page ad, all it said was, Ricky Dunn is a thief.
Oh, brilliant.
And then, of course, follow-up weeks later, you know, he's a pickpocket.
Sure.
But that, I just love that, because that got everybody going, who's Ricky Dunn? What did he do? You know?
Right.
It was just, I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah. A very smart guy. Anybody else you remember working with way back when?
Jules Lanier.
I didn't know Jules very well. I'd met him a time or two.
Jules was, because I grew up in Montana. I think I mentioned that to you at some point.
Well, we've been friends for a long time. I mean, going back to the Magic Island here, so when we first met, but yeah.
I grew up in Great Falls, Montana, and there were no magic shops. I learned magic through books from the library. Mm-hmm. And at my public library, they had an old Tannen's magic catalog.
Catalog, yeah.
Oh, I thought this was just brilliant. I mean, it's so thick. I don't know if you remember those catalogs. Hardback, you know, 1,000 pages. I was just flipped these.
And it had some sort of a celebrity like Copperfield or Siegfried and Roy on the cover or something. Kind of thing. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I would read the descriptions and look at the little hand drawings of the items and try and figure out how the trick was done.
Yeah.
And but then on my birthday or Christmas, I got to order something. My mother would call and order me something. And one of the things, I got some little pamphlets, and one was a Jules Lanier bank night thing. And it was basically you took a piece of wood and made an X out of it. And on each end of the X, you put a bulldog clip, and you had a little handle at top, and suspended from each bulldog clip were four envelopes marked 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Right.
And you had the audience call them out, and you just lit them on fire, and the one that was left had a $100 bill in it. Hmm. And simplicity, I mean, it was just, it was a brilliant, super easy, and I don't know if you know how to do that. These are only magicians listening to this, right?
That's correct. Yes, you can go ahead and expose a little bit there.
The $100 bill is folded up and put up inside the bulldog clip. You know, it's in the envelope, but it's so when the fire
it's
burns,
being protected by the bulldogs. So there's a bill in every envelope.
Right. So I incorporated that into my show, and when I was 17, and then when I went to Magic Island in Newport Beach in '83, there's this little guy, and I'm not very big. I'm 5'9", and Jules was smaller than me. And he was I just knew he was this guy that read tarot cards in the lounge. Did they do that at Houston?
They did do tarot cards. Remember, there were psychics and fortune tellers, and they would read stones. I think
yes.
Meredith. What was her name? I remember.
Yeah.
They would read color swatches and stones and things like that. So crystal balls. Yeah. Palm reading. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Jules was one of the psychics in the bar area in Newport Beach.
Okay.
And I just knew him as Jules. I never knew his last name. And
you
I was
had made a connection in your mind from when you were a kid. No,
no, I was so overwhelmed with the whole place,
exactly.
You know, that, you know, my new boss was J.C. Wagner. You know, I was living with Jerry Camaro, and all these acts were coming through, you know, Francis and Willard, Glenn Falkenstein,
and yeah,
were coming through, Pendragons, all these guys that I'd read about. And one day after it was almost closed, and Jules wasn't doing a reading, and I would go and sit down and talk to him. And for whatever reason, I said, well, what is your last name? And he said, Lanier. I went, oh, okay. And I was like, wait a minute. Are you a magician? He went, yes. I went, did you play? He goes, yes. Oh, no. So it was just one of those, how stupid could I be? I've been talking to this guy for, you know, a couple of weeks and then didn't realize who he was. But he was just, he was more than content just to sit and do readings.
Right.
And he made good money doing that.
I've had experiences like that where I'm talking to somebody and realize afterwards, like, oh, you're the guy who actually created that trick. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. There are a lot of people. That's why I think it's important that we understand and respect those who have gone on before us and recognize certainly that we are standing on the shoulders of giants, and we are just recreating something that they've already kind of paved the road for that. Basically, we're just adding another level of asphalt across that, you know?
Wait, are you saying that magic was not created on YouTube?
So I want to ask you about readings and tarot cards. Yeah. So that's kind of a different thing in a direction. Certainly, as you said, that Jules had gone from magic into that. So are you inspired by him, or what was, I've got a lot of questions about this. Go ahead.
My life's path was pretty much set from when I was 10 years old. I spent about half, maybe two thirds of my childhood in the hospital because I had severe asthma and eczema. And that's really how I got started in magic. When I was 10, it was a particularly bad year for me. And I was in the hospital about 9 months that year.
Yeah.
The way my illness was, it was I would be in for a couple of months and then out for a couple of months, in for a few weeks, out for a few weeks, just depending on how bad the flare-up was. But when I was 10, it was bad. And I used to read. I still read a lot. And my dad got me a book on... I tell audiences my dad got me a book on card tricks. This is the book my dad got me, The Phantom at the Card Table.
Phantom at the Card Table, yes.
Which is really about cheating at cards.
Who wrote that?
I should know this. Eddie McGuire. Eddie McGuire.
Not the name I was thinking. Okay.
But he got me this, and he gave me a deck of cards because he thought that would occupy my time while I was sitting there.
Sure.
And it did. I loved it. And for a week, I'm sitting here shuffling cards that aren't here. For a week, I'm practicing with these cards. And I called her Grandma Jenny, but she was actually my mother's grandmother. She was my great-grandmother, came to visit me and saw me playing with the cards. And she said, I didn't know you liked cards. Here, let me show you mine. And she brought out tarot cards. And my dad would show up to the hospital for a visit. I would practice my card tricks with him. My great-grandma would show up, and I would practice my tarot cards with her. And that's, like I said, that's all I've ever done.
And you were about how old at the time when you were doing that?
10 years old.
10 years old, doing tarot readings.
I was learning the tarot. To be honest, I didn't know they were tarot cards, and I didn't know I was learning to do readings. You're familiar with the tarot cards.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So my grandma...
I've done a little bit of reading myself. That's why I want to get into some of this.
Yeah, my grandma would bring out her deck, which was an old Rider-Waite-style deck, and she would take out a few cards and show them to me and tell me stories about the people in the cards. In my child brain, I thought at the time that this was some kind of, you know, like storybook that she had taken apart.
Oh, so, sure, of course.
So here are some pages, you know, so she's just showing me these cards and what they mean. And she wasn't saying this is what this card means. She was saying, you see this guy, he's doing this because of this. And, you know, it was a year later. I was like, oh, I get what these are now. And I loved them. I love tarot cards. I love doing readings. I know that there are magicians that are going to be I can hear their eyes rolling now. And I don't care. But that's when I moved to L.A., Southern California, Newport Beach, I was doing the magic at the Magic Island at night. And I found a place, a little store that sold crystals and stuff. And I did readings during the day there under my real name. I don't want to shock anybody here, but T.C. Tahoe, not my given name. Okay. My name is Christian Lang. So I did tarot card readings under my real name. And I did, you know, comedy and magic under T.C. Tahoe because I didn't think they should be combined because I thought magicians are going to hate me and think that I'm just, you know, stealing people's money, ripping them off because magicians like to get on a soapbox for some reason. And I thought if my tarot card clients find out I'm a magician, they're going to go, oh, well, you're just cheating at cards here with me. So I really did keep it separate. And it really wasn't until I moved to Ecuador in, 2013 or something like that. The years all blur together.
Yeah.
But when I was living in Ecuador, for the first year, I think I mentioned, I didn't really tell anybody I was a magician. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really burned out on magic, but I wasn't in love with it anymore. I brought a bunch with me, but it was just for me. I didn't really do anything for anybody else. So there's a big expat community. There's a bunch of Canadians, Americans, and people from the UK in Ecuador. And they have gringo nights, three nights a week in different bars. They would all get together. So I started doing readings for all these retired people they were all mostly hippies, all about 10 years older than me, all had been to Woodstock, you know. So they were into it. And it was, like I said, a full year before anybody found out that I was a comedian and a magician. And once
they kind of start the ball rolling and they're saying, holy cow, would you do something more for me? And would you come over and do this or that? Or
absolutely. It was,
it's like you had moved from Ecuador. Then you moved, to Nigeria.
It alleviated a lot of, it made me think, why did I waste all this time keeping it separate? Because nobody cared. None of my people who knew me as a tarot card reader cared that I also did card tricks and told jokes.
They were able to separate that. They didn't think you're doing trickery when you're doing readings and vice versa.
Exactly. Exactly. And when I did my first public show down in Ecuador, then when my clients would come to me, I would tell them the story of how I learned both magic and tarot cards. And they were like, oh, okay, that's cool. You had a neat grandma. So that made me realize people will accept it. And that really was a turning point for my show. My show really did change after that, in that I incorporated my magic show really did change. And it allowed me to do this show I call Odd Wonders, because I could incorporate everything, you know, that I, it made it an easy transition to go from comedy to tarot cards, to psychic, to bizarre stuff. It made it all flow really nicely for me. And by just telling the truth, which was such an odd thing for a magician to do. I'm just telling him the truth, and they're going, oh, that's very cool. In fact, I did a show down. I'm not good at geography. Everything is, no matter where I am in the world, everything is down.
Okay.
Down in Castle Rock for Joe and Carol.
Yeah, Joe and Carol Massey. Yeah, Carol, Joe Givens, yeah.
Yeah, their Theater of Dreams.
Theater of Dreams.
I did my show there, and they wanted, 90 minutes.
Right.
And I have always been... Anytime anybody hires me for anything, they go, oh, you can do an hour. It's like, sure, yeah. Not at that point, I never had, but I figured I can do it. So I did, for Joe's show, I did my 45, 50 minutes of stand-up comedy magic. And then I sat down at the table, and I told some stories about my dad, which is my close-up show, essentially. But it's more story-oriented. And that transitioned into talking about Grandma Jenny and going into the bizarre storytelling. And the feedback I got from the audience, and I wasn't looking for it, but I'd go out and mingle after the shows, and repeatedly lay people would say to me, I really liked how you did your show, and then the second half was you just telling us about your life. Even though the second half had much more magic in it, they looked at it as, biographical, and that I was just telling them about me. And that's when I realized audiences really want to know about us. And if you look at your singers, bands and stuff, the things that when you go see them in concert, the things that I love are when they sit down on the stool and say, you know why I wrote this song? It was because of this.
Exactly.
And yeah, that's something that people want to hear. They want to get to know you,
I agree. Penn and Teller have talked about that then also. People are not interested in seeing the mystery or the ring disappeared or what comes back on a keychain, all great tricks or whatever. However, people want to know about you. And they want to know the stories behind you. And when you start to sit down with them and you are sharing those kinds of personal stories and history about yourself, I think that's what resonates most. For an example, recently Derek Delgadio had finished 552 performances of In and of Itself in New York City. And then there's the video that's on Hulu, produced by Steve Carell and his wife. Anyhow, during a portion of that show, he sits down, and as he is shuffling the cards expertly, he is talking about his years of being, kind of a crooked gambler, I guess, and the kind of the underside, the seedy people he had dealt with. And then he was just throwing out some hands and basically controlling the cards. But he was talking all the time and not trying to display this great skill that he had. It just happened to flow with the rest of the story. And I think that that's part of the whole show that resonated the most, of him talking about that, which he then, I guess, had put into a book, A Moral Man, Truths and Other Lies or something like that, which is available. I think it's still important. I, at the end, will do of my show many times after doing a lot of fun things or funny things. We'll do a gypsy thread in which I'm talking about my life and different things when I'm growing up and leaving home, going to college, getting married, having a child or another mm-hmm. child, and then them growing up, and then my wife getting ill and passing, and me going on, and then kind of the whole thread of life of what happens. And people get to know me through that emotional story, and that's what they will remember and come and talk about. And it's not like, oh man, how'd you make that card rise out of that piece of paper, or, you know, or whatever. Yeah. It's about you, about me. That's what they make that personal connection. I think that's why storytelling is great. And you do a lot of storytelling, isn't that right?
I do. I've always loved it. And most of my career, if people know me from anything, it's being really wacky and very energetic on stage. My mm-hmm. my whole opening is very, very fast. Okay. To the point where a lot of people are uncomfortable because they're like, is this going to be a whole hour of this? And then it calms down.
But I can't keep up with that pace.
Yeah, it's very Jonathan Winters, Robin Williams-esque. You know, I mean, I like that energy. I like that improv nature. So it was nothing I ever really incorporated into my shows until, you know, 8 years ago or so. And the shows have been much more fulfilling for me doing, because this is what I've always liked. You know, I've got a lucky card. I tell, you know, this is a story I tell in the show. It started off as a trick, and I realized that the trick doesn't need to happen because the story, people like the story. They don't care about the trick. The story is what they like, and it gets a better reaction without it being a trick. And
I've heard people talk about some magicians who will talk about having too many stories. In other words, you can overtell going from one story to another story, and then it becomes just a show full of stories. So I think you do have to be somewhat selective. So with that in mind, do you limit your stories to one or two, maybe three throughout the whole presentation? And if so, yeah. How long is each story, and what's your thought on that?
In my what I like to call my Odd Wonder show, I do some comedy magic so they can see my personality. You know, I mean, I like comedy. I like being both silly and smart, if that makes sense. I like to play my own straight man, so I can be a straight man and I can be the stupid one also.
Sure.
And then when I sit down at the table, the stand-up comedy, then I sit at the table and I bring out a deck of cards and I start talking about my childhood and my father as I'm doing some card stuff. It's really a story, but again, showing, you know, that I do know how to use cards. And then I kind of, then that is a little 5-minute story card slight routine. And then I just go and do, you know, a few cards things. And then I transition into a story about my grandma Jenny. And that is just a story. There's no trick there. It's just a story.
It's a nice segue.
The stories are wonderful segues because now the grandma Jenny story is a sweet story, still personal, but then has that little bit of bent on the supernatural. Mm-hmm. And then it goes into the more bizarre mind reading, whatever you want to call it, stuff. You know, I mean, bizarre is such a, it seems to be a loaded term. I mean, when regular magicians talk about bizarre magic, they think it's blood and you know, all H.P. Lovecraft, and it's really not. I mean, there obviously are aspects of that, but it's not all that. You know, I mean, I would look at someone like David Parr, brilliant magician, wonderful storyteller, and It's not full of blood and guts. It's full of history and stories that I don't think laymen are looking at going, oh, that is, you know, that's creepy. Bizarre. You know, it's so transition.
Yeah, our definition of what is bizarre versus what some the lay people and even some among magicians will consider it the different levels of bizarre. I was just thinking about Tony Andruzzi, for an example. Yes. I think of him as being a bizarre type of a magician. Sure. And he transitioned, of course, from having a comedy act, which he either gave or sold to Johnny Thompson, which Johnny did, that act, as he went into the more bizarre kind of
exactly. thing that he was doing. And he did what he loved. I mean, he did do more spooky, bizarre things and kind of started that. And I think that's what inspired a lot of people, which is why for a long time,
yes.
there was a lot of, you know, H.P. Lovecraft and vampires and that kind of stuff in bizarre magic. But it's not, you know, it's like, you know, I saw Slidini as a kid and that's what I wanted to do. And I emulated him. So I think that's why it gets, you know, people just think of Andrew, you know, they think of Tony and they think that's bizarre magic when it's bizarre magic is really storytelling magic.
Is there really an arc, if you will, from the beginning to the end of your show? Do you build it so that you have callbacks throughout your show? You're talking about having segues of stories from one to the next. Do you kind of feel the way you script your show that you do have this arc?
Yes, I believe so. Whether it's apparent to anybody in the audience or not, I do not know.
Okay, but you have an intellectual intent to do that.
I do. I have a rudimentary, this is for any tarot card readers, I have a rudimentary version of the Fool's Journey in my show. It goes from me being naive and goofy and silly to more reflective to then more meaningful, hopefully. That's the way it plays out.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does end, it ends on a fairly serious note. My comedy show does. So,
okay. And so that's kind of funny that you would not leave them laughing. You leave them wondering, I guess, huh?
Yeah. It's like I said, you know, I end on a fairly serious, what is meaningful for me. And I, you know, I've seen people and talked to them afterwards and they get what I'm doing, but I have added in an encore that nobody asked for to leave them on a bit. It's twofold. I do, my show goes from the comedy to the sleight of hand. This is the way it is in my head. Comedy, sleight of hand, bizarre mind reading storytelling. And once I shift to the Grandma Jenny portion of the show, which is all the bizarre and storytelling stuff, I'm no longer as funny. I can't not be funny because that's my nature. My nature is to mock. And yeah. So I will make fun of myself even during serious routines. But I end the show with a slate routine and a personal story. And I sit back and then I say, do you guys want to see one more trick like from before? And I really do that, and it works well in a theater setting because it really does cement in their minds, wait, the stuff you just did, that wasn't a trick? It makes them question, if I'm saying it like that, oh, you know what, that was good, it's a little bit heavy, let's go back to the fun stuff. You want to see another trick? As opposed, you know, I'm not saying as opposed, but I'm implying as opposed to what I've been doing.
Right.
And then it's an upbeat musical thing, so...
So, yeah, you don't give a disclaimer or anything beforehand, but you let them kind of make it up in their mind of whether this is real or not.
And it's, you know, like I tell a story about, you know, my grandma Jenny and how she taught me how to make a wish come true, which is all true. And it's, you know, a little metaphysical, a little magical, but it's true. And most of it's true. I should say that. Most of the stories I tell are true. And I think that is the important thing when doing a storytelling or doing any kind of storytelling is that some of it has to be true and it has to be faithful to who you are. You know, what I remember being a kid and saying, oh, I have here this jar that I got in Tibet. I was like, I'm 12. When did I go to Tibet? You know, and unfortunately, you know, magicians don't always put themselves into their magic, which I think is a big mistake. People can, even if everything I say is not true, enough of it is true where people understand that what I'm telling them is true. Does that make sense?
it does, actually, in a funny way. That's true.
I stopped listening to myself about 5 minutes ago. Sorry.
Along that line, did you transition then also into doing seances? I mean, I've done a lot of seances then as well. Uh-huh. That seems to be a natural progression, I would think, from psychics and fortune tellers and tarot cards and bizarre.
Mentalism, bizarre, seance stuff has always been a passion of mine. It's mm-hmm. nothing I ever thought I could really pull off, because when I'm on stage, I'm still in that improv mode where I'm still looking for a laugh. So unless I approach it as an actor, which, you know, I have some background in that, unless I approach it like that, it's never really comfortable for me. But yeah, I did a theatrical seance, which was more of a play. Remember that old play, The Wedding, Italian people getting married. An immersive play where I think it's like Tony and Tina's Wedding.
Fat Tony's Wedding or something like that?
Yeah, where you buy tickets and you show up basically. The actors are all around you, and you don't know who an actor is or who another cast member is.
Yes.
And you're part of this.
It's an immersive experience. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's the way I like my seances.
Okay.
Because it allows you to, you know, the pre-seance was a little cocktail party, and I had people in there getting information. You know, this is Susie. She's going to test your ESP. And she would go through some tests, but she'd also find out information. Now we're gathering information without them really knowing it before we go into the seance room. So, yeah, I like the immersive thing.
Along with Jamie Salinas, done seances for a long number of years. And we try to approach it from different ways of whether we are going to be a real genuine psychic. Are you trying to have someone who's going to lead you, or are you going to try and contact the other world? All kinds of things and different emotions that all that will bring up. And we finally settled upon of us just basically being ghost hunters in a way. We're still questioning this. We're still wondering, like you are. We don't know what's really out there, if anything at all. And so let's go on this exploration together and see if we can find something.
And I think that's a great way to do it, because you're basically becoming one of the audience members then at that point, because that's their frame of mind too.
Yeah, that's true. Where do you find that you can perform these seances? Do you go into people's homes and do that? I assume you do that tarot readings privately, but when it comes to seances, have you found like a public venue where you can go and perform, or?
You know what, to be honest, I have not done any seance stuff in a couple of years, not since I've been back from Ecuador.
But when you did beforehand, when you were doing those, would you do those privately, or did you ever do public shows?
I mostly do them privately, but I had a magic shop for a couple of years in Burbank, California, called
Mind Over Magic.
And that was a horrible experience.
I was about to say, what were you thinking to open up a brick and mortar magic shop?
I was thinking I was doing cruise ships, and I wanted to be home a bit more, but because I was known at the castle, I'd get a lot of magicians, you know, come to the store, and I didn't understand, because I'm slow on the uptake, I did not understand why I was exhausted at the end of every day.
And you were burning too many candles at too many ends.
Well, finally, Leslie pointed out to me, you are sitting there giving advice. You are essentially doing an 8-hour lecture every day for these people. Hmm. And because if somebody says, hey, I'm thinking of doing this, you know, I have never been a great salesman. You know, Leslie's like, give them your card and say, you know, you can do a one-on-one class with them. I would just go, well, I would do it like this. And if you, here, let me write a couple lines for you, because I think this would be a good, you know, I'm not a good salesman. You know, I just give it away.
Well, you were nominated as being a lecturer of the year by the Academy of Magical Arts. What did you like, and what do you lecture on then now?
Everything. I now
I mean, all the things we've just been talking about, as far as magic, mentalism, tarot, and everything, and yes, comedy.
I wrote. You know, it's funny. There are certain groups of magicians that I wrote a book called "In the Play of Shadows," which is all tricks with tarot cards, all storytelling tricks with tarot cards. I wrote. I wrote a pendulum book, a big ass pendulum book. My section is small. I say it's a great book because it's got. You know, it's got Jeff McBride. It's got, I think, Dan Sperry's. There's a lot of people contributed to it simply because I was doing a lecture. I've always been a fan of pendulums. And I was saying in one of my lectures, you know, you can do a lot of pendulum work. And I teach people how to use a pendulum. And my good friend Eric Olson said, why don't you sell a little pendulum book with your tricks in it? Mm-hmm. And I went, yeah, okay, you know what? Because I'm not a salesman. Yes, that's a great idea. Thank you. So I sat down and wrote this little pendulum book. It's like, you know, it was like 20 pages. And I wrote to my friend Richard Webster in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And I said, would you mind, since you really, Richard was the one that really got me going on pendulums, I said, would you contribute something to this? He went, sure. And he sends me something. And he goes, oh, I mentioned it to Doc Hilford. And then I get an email from Doc going, here's a routine for your book. And it just kind of steamrolled into this, you know, 600-page book on whether you approach pendulum as magic with a K, bizarre stuff, or scientifically. It's all in this book. Wow. And so,
what's the name of the book?
It's called T.C. Tahoe's Swingers Party.
Swingers Party, because I got it. Okay, the pendulum swinging, yeah.
As it says in the introduction, it's called the Swingers Party. Because my wife wouldn't let me call it T.C. Tahoe, Why I Swing Both Ways.
Good for her.
Yeah.
She kept you on a leash there on that one.
Yes, she did. But I've written a lot of books that are mentalism and bizarre. So I went and did the East Coast Spirit Sessions, which is a wonderful convention, a small convention in January in Myrtle Beach. And I went to this bizarre magic convention because I wanted to try out my mentalism and bizarre storytelling stuff, because a lot of magicians that I know were like, well, that's bizarre magic. And I'm like, it's not, compared to what I think of as bizarre magic. So I went to this convention really to see if they would accept it, if it really was bizarre magic. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I went there and I was laying things out on my table in the dealer's room. And one of my books is called T.C. Tahoe, His Bizarre Side. And a guy came up and goes, your bizarre side, what's your other side? These guys only knew me from the books and the magazine that I published.
Oh.
They didn't really know that I was a comedian.
Yeah.
So it was interesting, because I did a magazine for 2 years called Mind Over Magic.
There was a convention then for a while also, again, going back to Tony Andreuzzi, they started the thing. I mean, long before the Mindvention in Vegas, mm-hmm. That Danny Archer was doing, but there was another one I know that Doc Hilford and Rick Maui and all these other guys who would attend. What am I trying to think of? It's, what was that called? It was a bizarre convention. I think the Hilton Chicago. I think the PEA may sponsor it.
Maybe it was the Weird Weekend, but that was...
That's it. No, it is the Weird Weekend. That's okay. What I was thinking of.
Well, Vince... Do you know Vince? Vince Wilson. Wilson?
Sure do. Vince, I had him on an episode sometime ago, Vince, around Halloween. Yeah,
Vince is great. Vince is great because he is keeping this whole bizarre movement alive. You know, he's got the bizarre hauntings coming up in
Baltimore,
and he's doing one day is going to be a celebration of Weird Weekend.
So, okay, because that's what I was about to say. We haven't had a Weird Weekend then in years, right?
Yeah, so you're going to have one this year. So
interesting. But yeah. There were just a ton of stuff we've talked about and covered over here. As we start to draw to a close, I want to ask you, but the name of my podcast is called the Magic Word Podcast, which means I always like to know from my guests, what is it that inspires them? And what is it that keeps you going each day and gives you encouragement? What is not necessarily a word. I don't mean like abracadabra either. What is your philosophy of life? What do you live by?
I have I have really tried to live by, you know, Baloo, the bear, that, you know, the bear necessities, that as you look around, I've got tons of crap, but it's,
don't we all?
I like his philosophy of, just floating down the river, you know, don't work too hard, just go with it, which might explain why, not many people know who I am, because you know, I am not, I have never been, much to Leslie's chagrin, I have never been one to look for work. I have never been one to pursue big work goals. I did a bunch of stuff for the Disney Channel in the mid-80s, and I hated it, and I didn't do it again. I thought, I don't want to do TV. I was working at Caesar's Magical Empire in their big parlor room, the Dragons. It was great, and Gary Ouellette was filming one of his magic specials at the time there.
Yeah.
And one of his producers came in and said, TC, Gary would like you to do something for the show. And I just said, no, thank you. And he was like, no, no, to perform something for the show. And
that's not the expected answer.
No, and I just said, I appreciate it, but no. And then like 15 minutes later, Gary came over and said, I think there was a misunderstanding. I want you to perform for the show. I went, I thoroughly appreciate it. It means a lot that you'd ask, but I don't have any interest in doing TV. My energy doesn't come across. I don't like the end product. I don't have control over the editing. I just don't like it. Mm-hmm. So I could have, you know, been on a lot of TV shows, and I just chose not to, you know. I mean, I'm happy doing just what I enjoy doing. I just want it to just, you know, and that's really, you know, do what makes you happy. Honestly, I don't have a lot of money in the bank, but I'm happy. So what more could I ask for?
Yeah, you have been doing what makes you happy, basically, is what you're saying. And
absolutely.
Stay true to your belief of what you want to do that makes you happy.
Yeah, as much as I hate the saying, follow your bliss. Do what makes you happy. You know what? If making millions of dollars makes you happy, then go for it. But I just, you know, want enough money where I'm comfortable and don't have to worry about rent.
Right. Yeah. I mean, how many millions do you need to be happy at some point?
I'll plug this real quick. This is what I lecture on a lot.
Master of Ceremonies. Okay.
This is a little book I wrote. I, for whatever reason, fell into something in LA for years throughout the 90s. I became known as the guy to MC shows. I would always get hired to be the MC.
Mm-hmm.
And
is that a book of how to
yes, yes,
be an MC, or are there gags and
there are some gags in it, but it's mostly the way I MC, the way I look at it, my philosophy on hosting and MCing.
Yeah.
I ended up writing the book because when I was working for Carnival Cruise Lines for years, I started helping them train their hosts. Because, you know, they'd get 19, 20-year-old kids that have never held a microphone. And I remember one girl came on and she was doing this, and we've got Bingo at the back. This is her microphone. We got Bingo over here. We've got a swimming contest. So
pointing at the microphone instead of keeping it by her face. Yeah, exactly. Just some basic things you should know. Yeah.
So I put together a whole little lecture for them, and I went, well, I should be doing this for magicians too. So you can get this from me.
At tctahoe.com, or where are you?
Yeah, tc@tctahoe.com is my email. tctahoe.com, you can reach me from the website. You can get it on library.com. You can get the physical book from amazon.com. There's a few of my books on there.
That's
great. Not a good thing. Find them, buy them if you want.
Find them, buy them. Yeah, sounds like you got a nice philosophy of life, just kind of floating on your back down the river.
Yeah. No retirement fund, but hey.
You can float off into the sunset. There you go.
I have the same retirement plan that the big Irishman, Irish comic magician, Billy McComb. Good Lord.
Oh, Billy McComb. Yes.
Billy McComb said to so I was standing next to him when somebody, they were having a serious conversation about IRAs and, you know, the future. And Billy said, my retirement plan is I'm going to work until I die. I was like, yeah, you know what? Because I don't really see myself wanting to stop. So as long as people are going to keep paying me, that's my plan too.
Just kind of be, I guess, like Tommy Cooper and just go, yeah, while you're performing.
Yep, exactly.
Well, listen, it's been just a superb, wonderful hour. Thanks very much, TC. Great catching up with you, my friend.
Thank you. It was great seeing you and catching up with you, too. I can't believe it's been an hour.
Wow, time flies, yeah. Just like the years have over the last. I look forward to seeing you in the real world here sometime soon.
I hope so.
Until next time, that was TC Tahoe, and this is Scotty out.
Well, so there you have it, number 610 episode, and that was an awesome one with TC Tahoe. Thank you, TC. I appreciate all the suggestions and advice that you had given us, and again, more food for thought for our listeners. So I thank you for being our guest here this week, and that is a good philosophy of life. Just kind of float on down the stream, just kind of like the bear, I guess, on your back, and just relax and don't take anything too serious. But anyhow, I want to thank everybody again for tuning in and for listening. And oh, I told you at the beginning, we're going to announce who the winner of the contest was for a free copy of Grandpa Magic by Alan Kronzig. And there were dozens and dozens of people who had registered for this contest, but there was only one winner that could be selected. And that winner's name is Rick DeNatale. Thank you, Rick, very much for entering the contest, and congratulations to you. And may I also thank all of the rest of the registrants who came in to the podcast episode on the website and filled out the form. And also, they were probably some of the early people who learned about this. In fact, as it happened, because there were so many people who had registered, it is a randomly generated number, but you never know. And actually, Rick's number was number 6. He was the 6th person to have registered. So it can be anywhere from number 1 all the way to however many it could be. But the point is, he probably learned about this maybe from the podcast, but he also is a subscriber to the Pod Letter, which I suggest all of you to do as well. So this way you could be among the first to learn about these contests, and perhaps your name could be randomly selected for an upcoming contest, which we will be having sometime in the near future. I don't have anything in mind right now, but when we do, you'll be the first to know about it because you will be a subscriber to the Pod Letter. And of course, we always announce them here on the podcast as well, which I appreciate you listening to each week. And all you need to do is just go over to iTunes, if you will, please leave us just a 5-star rating. And again, favorable comments are always appreciated. So until next week, stay well. Get booked, and remember to always follow your bliss and do whatever makes you happy, as long as it's legal. This is Scotty out.